Well, 2016 is on track to become the warmest year on record. Here in the Midwest, we've seen record low levels of snow and ice on the Great Lakes, a hot summer, an unusually warm fall. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at all those things and a whole lot more with our two guests, our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, great to have you back.
Great to be back, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, who directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison, also a member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be here on a lovely December day.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the past year in weather and other weather-related topics, and you may have one, and I hope you'll join in. With your questions or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo. We'd love the weather photos or a question on our Facebook page. And the Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to have you back and love to hear from you. This year, likely going to be the hottest, warmest on record, isn't it, globally?
Globally, I can't see it be anything else. I mean, it's like 5 months where we're the warmest months individually on the record. So,
yeah.
How did it shape up here in Wisconsin?
We're going to end up above normal in terms of temperatures. We've had, thinking back, most of the months were above average or just about average. Some of the summer months were just about average.
Yeah, I think the summer months, it's curious that the summer months, I think even when you look over a period of 10 years, those are the ones that struggle the most to be well above average. The fall and the winter have a little bit less difficulty being above average. And that's curious and worthy of investigation. But, yeah, that's right. I think we'll be a little bit above average for the year.
And comparing to 2015, let's say, that was the hottest, warmest on record, I believe.
It was either 2015 or 2012.
Yeah, some place in the very recent past. Yeah. So we keep on, changing the record almost yearly. So it's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Are there any stress points in our state that would make it particularly vulnerable to climate change impacts?
I'm not an expert in that, but I think there are things I already know about these things somewhat anecdotally that, for instance, the temperature of streams from which a lot of tourist dollars are generated for people coming up and fishing and buying licenses and whatnot, the fish that live in these streams are extremely sensitive to the water temperature. So river, trout that live in the rivers don't do so well reproductively if water gets too warm, for instance, at certain times of the year, and that's beginning to show up in the statistics. So it's really scary.
You know, there was another, I just saw this a couple of days ago in the Washington Post. There was an article about the polar caps and the fact that the warming there could result in cooling elsewhere. And they were quoting a colleague of yours from the UW.
It might be Jason Salmonow. He writes the Washington Post weather blog, which is a really outstanding contribution to the discussion of these issues on the national level. It's Jason's master's degree graduate of our program. Great guy, really intelligent young man doing a great job there. One of the things that's interesting about these issues is if there's more water exposed at high latitudes in the late fall, he and another colleague of ours, not from the department, but Judah Cohen is his name. He works, he's like me, he's kind of a winter freak. He likes the wintertime the best and snow. But when the water is open over the northern part of the Barents Sea, north of Siberia, for longer than normal, it puts snow on the ground, lake effect kind of snow on the ground, earlier than it would otherwise be. And as a consequence, that can help to manufacture a fairly cold air early in the season in Siberia, Mongolia, parts of the northern hemisphere in that part of the globe, the eastern hemisphere. So really, really interesting feedbacks that seem somewhat counterintuitive, but upon scraping away the surface, you realize, no, that makes physical sense, but it's odd that it does.
Yeah, it really is. And we've got thinning ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland, do we not?
Yeah, both of them this year are below average, particularly the Arctic. The Arctic has really got a lot of open water right now.
Yeah,
which is odd for a December time of year.
And thin ice, too, as you point out. I mean, it goes away almost to such an extent in many locations that when it does refreeze in the winter, it just doesn't get very thick, so it doesn't have any long-lasting existence there.
And then thinking about the Great Lakes, how have the Great Lakes been affected by the warming trend? Or
less, us, less ice on time periods,
yeah.
Both the Great Lakes and the inland lakes as well. I mean, historically, you know, going back hundreds of years, 150 years or so, you know, our lake should be frozen by now.
Yeah,
and
right.
They're not.
That's
they're
right.
not even close, actually.
Yeah, and now, and it's running away in the other direction, as everybody knows. Yeah, we had a cold early December, and now it's been warm for 2 weeks or a week, 10 days, and it doesn't look like it's turning around anytime really quick to get desperately cold anyway.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the Great Lakes, remember a couple of winters ago when they had almost 96 or something percent coverage over all five of them?
Yeah.
That's when the lake levels went back up.
Yeah.
And it's a function of preventing evaporation.
Yeah.
So all these years we've been on the radio, that's been a recurring question. How come the lake levels are so low and it seemed to remain that way stubbornly? And I think part of it is the long-term integrated effect of less ice cover because it's warmer.
Yeah,
and they lose water by evaporation.
Makes sense.
Silent but significant.
Well, let's take some calls here, and you can join in, by the way, with your own weather question or observation at 1-800-642-1234. Any kinds of weather questions we're taking, for sure. Raleigh in Oak Creek. I'm sorry, is that right? Oak Creek?
Right. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the Weather Guys. My question actually begins with a little story. Hurricane Matthew was approaching Florida. I believe it was a Category 3 or a Category 4 storm with winds up to 130. But when I looked at the local forecast for the city along the coast there, it said 60, 50-mile-an-hour winds. And I thought, well, there's some I was wondering, is there are they measuring winds at different levels? Do people on the ground ever experience the 130, or do they just experience the 60? I'm just curious, how's that
sure.
speed recorded?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a couple of ways they record the winds of a hurricane. When it hits land, there's enough ground-based stations measuring the wind that they can pick that up. And so as it approaches the coastline, we start getting those land stations picking it up, or buoys that are near the coastline. The other way they do it is they fly planes into it. NOAA has some planes that do reconnaissance, because it's when it's out on the ocean, they don't have any really other observations, so they put planes into it. They also put planes up high, or now drones up high, that drop what we call drop-sons. They make temperature, moisture, and wind observations. So they actually drop them into the airplane. And then the final way is from satellites. So satellites look at the temperature structure, and from that temperature structure can predict a surface pressure, and from that surface pressure predict a ground wind speed at the surface level.
Yeah, okay. So there is some combination of direct observation, and Steve listed all of those, yeah. and some other that's kind of inferred from other direct observations. But it's also true that when a hurricane, even when it makes really close approach to the land, the radius at which the winds are well over 120 mile per hour, like in Matthew, is quite small in most storms. Sometimes it's fairly large, but in Matthew it was fairly small. And so if you don't have a direct hit, you won't get those kind of winds. And so a lot of the reports that actually come in, not having been affected by a direct hit, will say 60 to 70 mile per hour winds, which is still, you know, it's going to knock down a lot of trees and do some damage, but it's not 120 miles per hour.
Yeah, interesting.
Oh. Okay, well, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had a caller when we were talking with Stan Temple, just a few minutes ago, who called and wondered about a 40-year cycle in weather. He was talking about his father telling him this, and his father was a farmer, mm-hmm. and he thought that the weather more or less repeated itself in 40 years.
Mm.
And
it certainly, if we were to look at that, I think we would have to throw out the last 20 or 30 years or so where we really see human impacts on it. Prior to that, I don't know of any 40-year cycles.
Yeah, is there any sort of physical underpinning to it? There's nothing that I know of that's even been hypothesized. One that has been hypothesized is sunspot cycles, but that's about 22 years.
22?
Yeah. So and that hasn't been, you know, established very well by observation. So, yeah. I mean, in some ways, you live at a certain location for 40 years, you're going to see the same, broadly, the same kinds of distributions of weather over a period of time. And it may even be that you might recall one entire season that, boy, it looked a lot like this one. And, right. you know, it starts to give one the impression there's a cycle. I don't think there's anything physical that underlies that.
Marika was reminding me that he predicts next year will be a major snow year.
Hmm.
This fellow that called in.
About where, though? you know, if you live in Hurley, it's going to be a major snow week this week.
Year, right?
That's true. That's very true.
So that level of specificity has to be included. It's not crazy, but it's you have to include it.
Janet in Oconomowoc, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello there. Just an observation. I'm a backyard beekeeper, and my bees are all out today, cooking all over the yard.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, get them back in. The wind's going to turn to the northwest, and the temperature's going to drop.
Yeah, is it the warm weather, both the wind bringing in the warm weather, but also the sunny weather that brings them out?
It's the sun.
Yeah. Wow.
Even when it's cooler, they'll come out because they don't go to the bathroom in the hive. So in the winter, they wait for a day that's sunny, and they can come out and put little brown spots all over my backyard. I see them. I know they're there.
They must have a flight crew that goes out and says the conditions are, you know, IFR today or something.
Right.
Really, I mean, honestly, because it could be sunny and windy on a winter day, and that's not good, I would imagine.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they're flying around today. It's fairly windy, but I'm sure that they'll know before we do.
Yeah,
when
interesting.
It's time to go home.
Very interesting.
Thanks, Janet. And they do have ways of communicating.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah
to be
right.
perfectly honest.
Right.
And
so
they do communicate with each other.
So
and,
they must have recon. I would think they do.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
I'm pretty positive of that. Ron in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. I have a question. I've always heard that ocean waves and lake waves are measured from the sort of the backside instead of the face of the wave. So when they say a 10-foot wave is coming in, it might really be a 15-foot face or 20-foot face of that. Is that true?
I don't know.
Boy, you know, I don't know, and I'm trying to think. We just listened to this in the summertime, a book on tape about waves, and they were talking about how they measure it. And I don't remember. You're right. You know, as the wave is coming in, particularly as it's breaking, it builds up, and that front face looks steeper than what the back part of it would be.
And I thought that they do measure it as a half amplitude.
Half amplitude.
And when the significant wave height is indicated, I think it's half amplitude. So it's only the ridge, not the trough that comes behind it. So if you're out on a boat, I don't know if this is right, but let's imagine it were. A 10-foot wave really means a 20-foot canyon
wave.
Into which you fall because you're going from one crest to the downstream trough. But I don't know that either.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of that.
I can remember spending time in the Caribbean. I spent a lot of time on a boat there. Mm. And going into those troughs.
Yeah.
I mean, you were really way below.
And you can't see anything, right?
On either
side.
You can't see anything on either side. And kind of scary, but and that was on relatively, even reasonably calm days.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't have
to
look that one up.
Good question.
Somebody will probably call in with another answer or comment on it at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post one of those weather pictures on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Well, this is really seems like awfully strange weather to me. We had this month of December was a strange, strange month.
Yeah, it got really cold, and now it's kind of warm
weird.
And windy.
December 2000 was like this, although the cold and the snow lasted longer. You might remember we had all the way through, I think Christmas Day in 2000 was minus 20 or 24 degrees here in Madison, really cold. And then right after that, it warmed up, and it never looked back. The whole rest of the winter was mild, but we'd had a huge amount of snow, very dry, powdery snow and cold temperatures for that month, and that was the whole winter, and I have to tell you, I just have this weird suspicion that we just had that exact same thing repeated for this winter. Yeah, I just got this weird feeling.
Well, you know, you were right back in October about when winter came, it was going to come and seem really cold.
Yeah, and you know, the longer you go, we had such a warm October, November, it just, as soon as it turns even slightly wintry, it's going to feel like you're falling off a cliff, and it did.
Yeah.
Well, we've got some more questions to answer here, and you may have a question as well, and I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. I almost said John Ackerman and Steve Martin.
Oh, God forbid. Nobody wants that.
We'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Happy to have you with us today on the Ideas Network, talking about weather and climate today. We took a look back at the past year a bit and how it shaped up weather-wise, and we're looking still back, if you want, and we can look forward, too, with our two guests, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW, and Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also a member with John in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We have callers online. There's one open line left at 1-800-642-1234, so give a call. Ron in La Crosse has a question for you guys. Ron, hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, I heard earlier this fall that there was talk that we're going to have a La Nina winter. And I was just wondering, could El Nino follow a La Nina in the same winter season?
Not in the same winter season. They do tend to follow one another. We are in a La Nina now. It's kind of a weak one, and they're predicting it to continue to be weak over the next couple of months.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what does that produce for us?
So for us, it doesn't have as strong a connection as the El Nino does, particularly a strong El Nino. For us, in terms of southern Wisconsin and a little bit of eastern Wisconsin, that often means we'll have a above normal precipitation, and temperature could go either way, above normal or below normal. It's not that strong of a signal, as I remember.
David had a question on Facebook. It ties in with what Ron was asking about. He was wondering how climate change might affect this winter in combination with a La Nina in progress.
That's a good question. Yeah. As Steve just pointed out, the La Nina doesn't have a strong signal here. It doesn't really have any determinative sort of influence on our weather here when you look at the long-term record. But the climate change that's going on in the background, of course, is kind of just raising the bar across the globe. And it doesn't mean you won't get winter, and we all know that. We've had that several times in the last few winters, and most notably the first 2 weeks of December were very cold. Not historically cold, but certainly abnormally cold. And so you still can get visited by that. It's just that overall, the whole length of the winter, I think, in many locations, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, you won't have a pervasively cold winter as likely today as you would have 50 years ago in certain places. So I suppose, in a way, that the dice are a little bit loaded against a cold, long cold winter for both of these reasons, but maybe predominantly for the climate background climate warming reason.
Yeah. Mark in Belleville, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, g'day guys. I'm interested in finding out about the GO satellite program. I had heard that there were some problems with funding, and that maybe some of the newer technologies were not getting up into space.
Well, there were some funding issues in terms of the price tag. It got more than first anticipated, and it seems like that happens a lot with a lot of different programs these days. The current GOES program is going fine. In order to try and keep costs down, what the government ends up doing is instead of buying one copy, they'll buy four copies. And so that helps with costs, which is a good thing. The bad thing is those four copies last us, you know, to 2030 and beyond, which means we're not getting any new instrumentation beyond then. And so the new technologies that are developing now won't find their way necessarily into these NOAA satellites until, you know, 2035 or later. Yeah. Fortunately, they get wrapped up into NASA satellites.
And we've talked about this in the past, I think, but what is it expected to do that goes the GOES satellite?
So the new GOES
forecasting.
Yeah, the new GOES satellite, which was called GOES-R, it is now up in station, and so it's called GOES-16. It's not running yet. They have to outgas it, but they're running tests. They sent a signal down, and we picked it up, so that means we'll be able to get data from it. I think some of the good things it'll help with is prediction the onset of convection at a shorter time period, combining that with radar. They have a new lightning mapper on board, so I think, again, understanding convection a little bit better, those observations will help as well.
Interesting. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Carl in Verona. Let's go to you next. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I have a question about the possible methane release in the Arctic Ocean, specifically the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. I've read that the hydrates are rapidly collapsing there, and that we could possibly get a huge burst, a 50 gigaton burst of methane due to the rapid warming of the seafloor in the Arctic. And, of course, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. I'd like to get your guest's opinion. Could this happen? Could we get a very rapid burst of methane? And if so, what effect would that have?
Yeah, methane is one of the most potent greenhouse gases in terms of its ability to retain, reabsorb outgoing infrared radiation and then re-emit it to the surface. So it's not something we want to be putting into our atmosphere. And what's going on in the Siberian plain as it approaches the ocean, I think this is true, that you have decaying vegetable matter, some of it very, very old, of course, the kind that produces peat in the British Isles and other places. It's not completely unrelated to that, but it stays frozen for a good long time of the year because it's so cold there through their long winter, that a lot of it stays in ice form and therefore trapped chemically. It can't outgas into the atmosphere. And the fear is that if there's, increased warming that allows the ice season to be shortened significantly, then you'll actually lose more of that methane to the atmosphere, and that only provides even more feedback toward warming the planet some more in the high latitude northern hemisphere. So there's that concern. I don't know about the abrupt sort of catastrophic event scenario that you're describing. It maybe that's possible, but it's a little bit outside my expertise. I don't want to say that I know one way or the other if that's really a legitimate threat or not.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of research on this methane cycle, where the sources are, where they're coming from,
and
how they'll come out of the both the ocean floor and the tundra.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say we're approaching a cliff or a horizon that may have a cliff on the other side of it. I don't know if we all know or agree that it's a cliff. That's what I guess another way to look at it.
But we see it.
Yeah, it's something is not right is possible, right?
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Carl.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. On to Diana in Woodruff next. Hi, Diana. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I got kind of I'm concerned about this system that's coming out of the Dakotas. I'm looking at a move on Thursday, and do you guys happen to know what direction that might be heading? Does that affect Wisconsin at all or somewhat, or... Can you tell me anything about that?
I guess my first question is, where are you moving to? Hopefully not the Dakotas.
No. I'm moving from Woodruff to Antigo.
Just
as far as road conditions.
Yeah. Well, the reason why we're so warm, I don't know how warm it is up in Antigo, but it's pretty warm down here. We're in the low 40s today. That is related to that weather system in the Dakotas. We're on the eastern side of it, so we have really strong southerly winds. Bringing warm air.
Well, I can see ice dripping off the roof, but that could change.
It will change. In fact, it'll change first there up in Antigo, and it'll change down here later on today. The winds will come around in the northwest, and the temperature will go back down. But not desperately cold, because this storm is going to keep making its way up into central Ontario toward Hudson Bay. So we're going to get colder, but the real cold won't come in until probably late Tuesday and Wednesday. So I think, if the roads, they're going to be exposed to a lot of sunshine today, they ought to be relatively dry. Tomorrow morning they will be icy because there'll still be snow melting during the day today. But, once they get driven on a little bit tomorrow, they won't be so bad. That's my guess. But I would still proceed with caution because they will freeze tonight.
Well, I'm thinking of Thursday because that's when I'm making the trip.
By the time Thursday comes, there won't be any new snow probably. Maybe up there because there'll be some lake effect snow. But it won't be very much, and that might actually help the roads to at least you'll see the ice a little bit more, obviously, if there's a little bit of driving and people avoiding rough patches or something like that with a little bit of snow on the ground. So, it'll be wintry, but maybe not desperately serious.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And it was, I tell you what, doing my little 3-mile jog this morning, and there were patches here and there.
Yeah. God, you got to be in the sun.
Really be careful. I saw people, I'm just kind of wandering along at a very slow rate, and people running by, and I'm thinking, don't do it. Don't do it. Because there were slippery spots. that I was running
in shade too.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's the shade versus sun, and you can be lulled into submission. When you get into the shade, you got to watch out. Yeah.
My feet were kicking out from under me a few times, but I never landed on the pavement on my butt. Yeah, but it was close a time or two. Well, let's take some more calls. Peggy in Darlington up next. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had this hypothesis during the summertime that the density of the corn planting has resulted in an increase in humidity.
Okay.
That's a good hypothesis.
It sure is. Verifiably true.
True. Corn pulls a lot of moisture out of the soil and moves it into the atmosphere. And you can see this generally. I know people have done measurements looking at air as it moves over cornfields, and you can see the humidity go up.
Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah. We have a colleague, Professor John Norman, who told me once, because I was interested in something related to this question, I said, tell me about Iowa. And he says, you know what about Iowa in mid-July, about 10th to the 15th of July, when the corn is at its worst water management stage? It might as well be, the whole state might as well be a 6-inch deep inland sea.
Wow.
That's how much water gets evaporated from the surface because of the corn. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Wow.
Do you think that also affects our snowfall?
Probably not. That water vapor is carried away so quickly or involved in thunderstorms during the season at which it's being transpirated by the corn that it doesn't have a lasting seasonal effect for the next season downstream. But except insofar as it may allow the lakes to be at reasonably high levels because of winter summertime convective storms that might fill the lakes. That's the only way I could see them connected.
And water cycles pretty quickly through the atmosphere.
Yeah,
kind of
9 days.
On the order of 9 days.
Yeah, 9 days.
Yeah.
Wow. There you go, Peggy. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Mike in Winchester, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So we're heading out to Florida tomorrow morning, and I'm just kind of wondering how the road conditions and what the trip is going to be like for the next couple of days. So we're fortunate enough to get out of here. So.
You should be all right.
You should be all right, except you said in the morning you're leaving again?
Well, we're leaving in the morning. We're not sure what exact time. We usually leave about 4 o'clock, but we might be leaving around 6 o'clock, just a different little
game plan. I mean, the highways are probably going to be pretty clear.
I would think so, yeah.
Patches of ice
I would
around.
Think so.
Yeah.
And then when you get, south of Cobbendale, or if you're going by, toward Indianapolis, southern Indiana, you'll probably run into some rain, maybe even some thunder, but that's about all you have to worry about.
Yeah. Oh, perfect.
All right.
And No freezing rain, though, right?
Does not look like it on that route tomorrow into, Thursday morning. No, it doesn't look like it.
Perfect.
Safe trip,
okay.
Mike.
Thank you.
Enjoy. All right, take care. Don in Madison, hello.
Hello. Is there a way to measure how much wind energy passes a spot in 1 hour?
Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
I think it's the density of the air. You could measure that by knowing the temperature and the pressure, or you could infer it by knowing the temperature and the pressure, times the wind speed squared is the energy.
Right, yeah.
It's meters squared
and
per second squared.
Yeah, sum it up over an hour.
Yeah, and sum it up for over an hour. That's every second. How much energy is going by every second? You could do that.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
You better be quick on your feet, that's for sure. Let's go to Kathy in La Crosse next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, guys. I had a couple of questions. I'm trying to move out to the Eugene, Oregon area in the middle of winter, and was kind of, I'd heard there was a lot of weather out on the coast, and was wondering, is that going to calm down in the next couple of months? Do you think I could get over the mountains and over to Eugene safely?
Boy, it's so wintertime, the passes, even if you are going to, depending on your route, but, Wyoming, where it's so open, I mean, you can get huge snowdrifts without a problem. And passes can easily shut down or require chains.
Within 12 hours.
Within
it's
12
hot
hours,
know,
yeah.
Climatologically, sometime in the next 2 months, you'll be able to
you'll
do it. But, and I know that's not helpful, but as Steve just pointed out, within 12 hours, conditions can deteriorate. If you're in, eastern Montana and you're trying to go through a pass in there, and suddenly it could be bad. So you have to be prepared for some stops.
Do you guys see any general trends just in the next couple of months as far as like when the weather just hitting the coast out there kind of will calm down this year at all?
That's a good question. I'd have to say no.
No, yeah.
There's no way to look that far in advance. with the kind of precision that would really be a helpful comment to you, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
And is it like is this a really common kind of occurrence out there? Is it usually really bad weather systems for a couple of months in Oregon, and then it just calms down, kind of like Northern Cali weather?
Sort of in a way. When the Pacific Northwest, I went to graduate school in Seattle, and I loved living there. The weather is interesting. Yeah. When it gets interesting in the wintertime, it stays interesting for a good long time during that season. So you're onto something. I think there is a tendency for a pattern that brings unusually wintry weather to like Portland, Seattle, Eugene, to last a little longer there than it might in a place like us. We just had 2 weeks of cold in December, and we're back to what we had earlier. So, but when it actually decides to clear up, that's hard to know. I don't really haven't paid much attention to that, even though I lived there for 8 years. That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
The good thing is, you know, we now have these smartphones, you know, so that as you're traveling, you could routinely check road conditions and see what the outlook looks like.
And you can join in, too. Open lines, finally, again. We went through several in a hurry here. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. All right, I'll post a photo. We haven't got any photos yet up on our Facebook page that I can see. I'll have to take a look again here on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. What apps do you recommend for traveling to track your route as you travel? What do you guys use?
I have a radar one that is really good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and think about it and let John talk
I don't really have one. We don't take long, long rides that involve worrying so much about the weather. But before I leave, I'll look at a radar from the University of Wisconsin-Madison website. We have a nice department website that has a lot of really great detailed radar data and then surface observations. And you can do them while you're driving, too. I don't know how many of the map apps actually have radar on top of them. Probably
they don't.
None.
Somebody should do that.
There's no reason why they
drives
can't.
Drives me crazy that somebody hasn't done that.
And I was just thinking what you said. You know, you could have a 40 or 50-year data set for Stevens Pass, let's say, in Washington State, where when the conditions look like this 12 hours prior to them closing the pass, why don't you say closing the pass is a distinct possibility in the next 12 hours? You could do that as a statistical algorithm.
Yeah.
And add that to a driving app. I think that'd be really
that'd
useful.
That'd be really good.
Yep.
Yeah.
I use RadarScope is one.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
Which is
a
really good one, and it gives you a lot of different options.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the National Weather Service has a nice app as well for looking at radar imagery. And that's the thing that I mostly get concerned about when I travel is where is it raining or snowing?
Yeah, me too.
Joe in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what drives the temperature measurement differences between ground stations and satellite measures? Or to say it differently, why is the correlation not the same? I understand why the temperature might not be the same, but why is the correlation not the same?
So the satellite observations near the ground are generally well correlated with the surface observations. It's hard for the satellite, just because of the physics of the measurement, to really get at that surface observation, which is not the surface of the ground. It's actually 4 meters above the ground.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's just hard radiometrically to make those measurements from a satellite and derive them. But the lower atmosphere in general is very well correlated.
And I think there's also something lurking, perhaps, I don't know, in this question, that there was some controversy some years ago. Remember this, where the satellite data record was suggesting that there was no more warming and the surface ops were suggesting the other end. What was that about?
It was about they weren't correctly accounting for the change in the satellite altitude. And so, the measurements kind of like they have what we call a weighting function, and, you know, they kind of get a peak at a particular wavelength. The peak of that is a function of the carbon dioxide concentration. And so typically if you're at the right altitude, then you know where that peak is. But then as time goes by, gravity begins to pull that satellite down. And if you don't boost it back up, which generally our operational weather satellites don't do, that peak moves further down and down and down. So they end up with
very interesting.
So that discrepancy, which a lot of climate skeptics have been long discovered and understood.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's great. That's helpful. So the discrepancy or the lack of correlation, for lack of a better term, has gone away. Is that fair to say?
That's right.
Yeah. It's been corrected for because we understood what was driving that weird aberration. Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for calling. Jim in New Berlin, thank you for calling.
Yes, I believe you your guest misspoke when he said that the energy of the wind was density times velocity squared, because the equation for kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared. So you'd have to take the density times the unit volume and divide that by 2 times the velocity squared. That's my comment.
Yes, that's correct. It's a very good point. In meteorology, we're always thinking about things per unit mass, and so we kind of are sloppy with the mass part of it. You're exactly right.
Yeah, good point.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, appreciate the call. Mark in Washburn. Hello.
Hi. I just thought I'd comment to let you know this morning some 9 anglers decided they'd go ice fishing on Lake Superior.
Wow.
Right in the bay here, Suwamigan Bay, and there's white caps out there beyond the ice. Well, before you know it, you know, they had to be rescued by the Ice Angel, which is a boat that can also go on ice.
Oh, man. 9 people.
Wow. 9 people. They all have the same idea.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so I've seen these some of these rescue things and the reasons for it. I'm wondering it's the same thing here. They go out on the ice, begin ice fishing. The wind picks up and it moves the ice sheet further away from shore.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden it's open water to shore and they can't get to shore. Is that what happened?
Yep. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Luckily, they have cell phones, you know.
Yeah. Not anymore.
Oh, thanks, Mark, for that little news item.
Yeah.
Oh, Joel.
You got to be careful in winter.
Yeah.
Joel, have you got a quick one?
Yeah, I was calling. Earlier, you spoken about the 9-day cycle between, I guess, evaporation and it coming back down. I expand on that. That sounds.
Yeah, okay. In 20 seconds, can you do that?
Yeah, a hydrologic cycle, it's called. So water vapor changes phase in our atmosphere. It's the only chemical that can do that. Goes from solid to liquid to gas in any sort of recycle. It takes about 9 days for a liberated water molecule in the vapor phase to find its way back to a liquid or solid in the Earth's atmosphere. So it does not last very long as a water vapor molecule in our atmosphere. In fact, that means that 40 times a year, all the water that's cycled by the atmosphere is recycled 40 times per year. Each time it does that, there's enough energy involved to fuel the Madison metro area for 250 million years.
And on that note, we probably won't be around 250 million years from now, but that's we true. Will be around in January. Happy New Year, guys.
Yeah, same to you, Larry.
See you next year. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us.